Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 2003. Today's session is For the Healing of the Middle East, Dueling Biblical Scripts, presented by Barbara Rossing with Lauren Johnson, ROB 2003-4. Let's listen in.
My name is Barbara Rossing, and I teach New Testament at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and this is
Lauren Johnson, and I'm married to Barbara Rossing, who teaches theology at Chicago.
And we're going to team teach this together, so we've each told each other, you can only have 20 minutes, okay, so I'm going to have to talk really fast and get everything in my 20 minutes. Okay.
She can.
But anyway, what we want to talk about today is the Middle East. This is the final session in a three-part series that I've been doing this week on the Left Behind novels and the Book of Revelation. I know some of you haven't been at the other ones because they were like Monday and Wednesday, so don't worry about that. You can listen to them all if you want to, or you don't have to. I don't know, you've probably seen this series of novels, right, in Costco or Walmart or whatever. Maybe some of you read them. Have any of you? You can admit it if you want. I've read them all. Okay, Christine, okay. Anybody else?
I've listened to a couple.
Okay, all right. Very good. Well, they're kind of fun Christian fiction, but the dilemma that I have is that I think they're based on a script for the Middle East and for the end of the world and a reading of the Bible that is really wrong. And so that's what I've been doing on this year on my sabbatical. So in a sense, if you want to read them as completely fiction, not just the characters who are Rayford Steele, this airplane pilot, who's while he's flying his plane, the people get raptured, including his wife. And I mean, if you read the whole thing as fiction, including the biblical interpretation, that's fine with me. But I have serious questions, I guess, as a New Testament scholar about the way the Bible is being used. First of all, there is no rapture in the Bible, in my opinion. We can talk about that. We talked about it a little bit on Wednesday. But the whole doctrine of the rapture was invented less than 200 years ago by a guy named John Nelson Darby in Great Britain. And it was exported to the United States and became hugely popular here. This is this idea that Christ's second coming is going to be a two-part thing. I mean, we believe as Christians in Christ's second coming. We say that in our creeds. We believe in the resurrection of the dead. But what the rapture people have done is take resurrection passages and apply them to this idea of this first second coming of Jesus, when he's going to supposedly snatch true believers up into heaven with him for 7 years, followed by this supposed seven-year period of tribulation, and then after which Jesus will come back to establish a kingdom on earth. Now, you've probably heard this theology. In fact, I will confess to you that even with a PhD in New Testament and a focus on the Book of Revelation, I had been so snowed by this kind of fundamentalist script for the end of the world that I thought, oh, well, the rapture must be somewhere in the Bible, but I just haven't seen it yet. You know, they must have some basis for it. And same thing with the seven-year period of tribulation. That's got to be there somewhere, but I just kind of missed it. No, now I have studied carefully, and I see that indeed it's not there. So what I want to do for you today is take you through some of the biblical texts, how they build this supposed script, just so you know where they're getting it, and hopefully I'll be able to persuade you that it's not there as we look at the text. And then what we want to do is talk about how, why it's so important for us to talk about this script for the end of the world, because it's influencing American politics and especially Middle East politics. The Newsweek article that I grabbed is in the June 2nd issue of Newsweek, very troubling here. It's this little article called A Very Mixed Marriage. Evangelical Christians lining up to fight for Israel may be an unmovable obstacle to Bush's roadmap. In other words, that of the, say, 30 to 50 million Americans that are buying into this fundamentalist, or what we call Christian Zionist script, and I'll talk about that definition because I think it is important to support Israel, but the Christian Zionist support is of a whole nother level. People who support that script think that there's absolutely no place for the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, because they think Israel needs to take over the whole land so that Christ can return. It's really a wild and crazy script. And whereas most of our churches would support the roadmap idea in the Middle East now, because it's a way of possibly getting to peace, which we seek, these people are not seeking peace. They're seeking the end of the world. And that's the big difference in the reading of the scripts. I, as a Lutheran, am in close contact with Lutheran congregations in the Middle East, but there are all other denominations as well. The largest Christian church is the Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox. And all of these are Palestinian Arab Christians who are just pleading with us as Christians, you know, don't buy into this ridiculous script for the end of the world and for what it's saying about the Middle East. But more and more Americans are, and in part that's because of the Left Behind novels, which are so popular, which have sold about 50 million copies. Okay, so let's look at some of these biblical texts. Basically, their idea for how the world is going to end, what they think the Bible says, what Darby started in 1830, and which had taken over hugely by 1880 when he died, or 1880s, I can't remember the exact year, is this idea that the second coming of Jesus is going to be this two-part idea, that here's the world up until now, and the world is divided, the world history is divided into what he called dispensations. The dispensation of Israel lasted up to the time of Jesus, and he finds it all. Why don't I just take you to his main passage? This is the passage that he thinks is the most important one in the entire Bible, which is Daniel 9, 24-27. I think it's the most obscure passage, but anyway, in the what we call the premillennialist script for the end, everything revolves around Daniel 9. Where there's this idea that there's going to be 70 weeks. I'm not going to have you read the whole thing because it's too hard to read. It doesn't even read well. 70 weeks are decreed for your people and your holy city. They interpret those weeks as weeks of years, which actually a lot of Bible scholars would agree that the weeks are actually years. Okay, so they think it's a script for 490 years of Israel's history. And what was supposed to happen, the most important verse is probably... 26 and 27. After 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off. Now, anointed one usually sounds to us like a Messiah figure, but no, they read this as the Antichrist. This is going to be a very bad Antichrist figure, which in the Left Behind novels is Nicholas Carpathia, the Romanian Secretary General of the United Nations, who then turns the United Nations into this one world government that is the evil Antichrist empire. And Christians then should oppose the United Nations, of course. Okay, so Antichrist is going to come to power, destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood, and the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. He shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week. That's where they get the 7 years. You hear this idea, 7 years of tribulation all the time. I mean, I believe that. You see it on TV. This is the only place they have to justify this idea of 7 years of tribulation. That 1 week of a covenant is the Antichrist making a covenant with the state of Israel, a treaty, and that starts their rapture clock. That starts their time clock for the 7 year period of tribulations, with the week being understood as years. And for half of the week he shall make sacrifice and offering cease, and in their place shall be an abomination that desolates until the decreed end is poured out upon the desolator. Okay, and that's, in their view, the framework on which the whole Bible hangs. This is God's view of history. So everything else that happens in the Bible, like Jesus, let's just say, you know, the Gospels, they all have to fit into this timetable. And this becomes then the governing framework for the Bible, which is, it has a whole lot of problems. I mean, first of all, nobody in the New Testament ever cites this passage at all, let alone viewing it as a framework. I mean, they don't even refer to it. But Darby made this the primary thing. So then what he does with his timetable, he's got all these dispensations. Then comes the rapture, and we don't know when that's going to be, but of course it's going to be really, really soon. And in their opinion, the founding of the state of Israel in 1948 really heated up the rapture time clock. God's got a stopwatch. When the Jews did not accept Jesus as their Messiah, the prophetic clock stopped. So the clock stopped after 69 weeks of years. And it's been stopped for the last 2,000 years in a kind of interval. But they are really eager for the prophetic clock to start back up. And the way it's going to start is when the rapture happens and this treaty is signed between Antichrist and the state of Israel. And then, boom, the clock can begin for that last week of years, those last 7 years of tribulation. Okay, so supposedly this rapture is going to happen. Then comes this seven-year period of tribulation, and they tell you all the things that are going to happen during that period. So Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, the authors of these novels, say, we don't know when the rapture is going to happen, although they want you to think it's going to be really soon. But once it happens, we can tell you the whole script for what's going to happen. God has a prophetic script, and it's going to play out. It's like a baseball game that's already been played and videotaped, and we're just going to watch the videotape unfold. It's all scripted in their view, because that's how prophecy works. Okay, so there will be the seven-year period of tribulation during which terrible things are going to happen on the earth. The wrath of the Lamb, earthquake, everything that's in Revelation, its seals, its bowls, its trumpets, all those awful things are going to be unleashed by God on earth. But Christians get to miss out on it, because we're going to be up in heaven watching, except I hope that I'm not, but maybe some of you. So it's a real sort of escapist mentality. You get to be beamed up, essentially, if you're a true believer. It's a real kind of beam-me-up theology, so that you're up in heaven watching, though. It's very voyeuristic. That's the other thing about it. It's you want to make sure to watch everybody writhing in pain and, you know, planes crashing, all that. But you're up in heaven watching. Then, after 7 years, Jesus comes back in Revelation 19 on a white horse with a sword coming out of his mouth. And it's a mix of literal and symbolic reading that is really funny. The four horses that are in the seals in Revelation, they say, are symbolic, but this horse in chapter 19 has got to be literal, so Jesus is riding back on his literal horse, and I want to see if he literally has a sword sticking out of his mouth. But anyway, and with him are the armies of heaven, Revelation 19 says, and in their opinion, then, that's Christians coming back with Jesus, which, you know, there's no evidence for that either, but this is the script. The armies of heaven means the raptured Christians who got taken up 7 years earlier come back and then start the millennial kingdom on earth for 1,000 years. And what's key to U.S. Middle East policy, if you can believe it, is that that millennial kingdom, they say, has to be centered in Jerusalem. Jesus told us, supposedly, that he's coming back to set up his kingdom on earth with his capital city in Jerusalem, and it's all going to be based in Israel. So that means that the Israel now, which is defined according to its biggest borders by most of the fundamentalists, this huge set of borders that's prescribed only in a couple Old Testament passages, all of that has to belong to the Jews. They'll get a chance to convert to Christ, but otherwise they all get killed. And that's why Israel, interestingly enough, and Jews in the United States are in a very tricky position wondering whether to support this or not. On the one hand, they love the Christian Zionist support for Israel, which is amazing. They've got this thing called the Christian Embassy, all their tours and stuff. There are partner relationships between fundamentalist Christian churches in the United States and the Jewish settlement outposts that are supposed to be dismantled now, but Christians want these outposts. They want the settlements to take over all the land in the West Bank. But it's a tricky issue for Israelis and Jews, because in the end, the script says if they don't convert, they're all going to get killed. Now, some will say, hey, you know, we're happy to partner with you for now. We know your script is ridiculous. But others say, no, no. And one book that I ordered for the bookstore that I would highly recommend to you, very lively, entertaining, shocking reading, is this one by this guy, Gershon Gorenberg, called The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount. He's Jewish, and he does not think that Jews should welcome the support of Christian Zionists, but he's, you know, speaking against a tithe. But anyway, he quotes a couple people. I'll just read one here. This is the guy who's the head of this thing called the Christian Embassy in Jerusalem. I believe in the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth with its capital in Jerusalem. The physical factor of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount become very important in my life. Because of archaeology, the Bible came to life. So this brings up what I was talking about on Wednesday, this idea that what's so appealing about some of this is the sense that the Bible is coming to life in our lifetime. That's the appeal in large part, I think, of the Left Behind novels, is feeling like we're living in Bible times. It's all coming to life. But I think that we as Christians have to then give a different understanding of the Bible coming to life, that it's not coming to life in disasters unfolding, in a script playing out that brings annihilation to Palestinians. That's not how the Bible comes to life. We need to talk about for the healing of the world, and where we've seen God's scripture coming to life in our lives. We need to present a compelling vision that is not about the end of the world as the way that we see God active. But that's our task, I think, as Christians, and it's a really important one, because fundamentalists of all, this is what the Gordenberg book talks about, and I can pass it around, fundamentalists of all three faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are becoming more and more extreme. And one, and the place where it centers then is the Temple Mount, where the first and the second temple of Judaism were built. The temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, and all that's left now is the western wall, the retaining wall, where Jews go to pray. But for Christian Zionists and some Jews, they think the temple must be rebuilt. They cite Revelation 11, 1-2, for example. But there's so many other passages in Revelation where the temple is in heaven. I think this whole argument is ridiculous. And what's really insulting to Jews is that they think the temple must be rebuilt just so it can be desecrated by the Antichrist, as this Daniel passage says. You have to have a temple so that there can be sacrifices, so that this anointed one can make sacrifice and offering cease, and desolations are decreed and abominations. I mean, this is ridiculous. God wants the temple rebuilt so that it can be desecrated by the Antichrist, but that's exactly what they want. And what's key is that the thing is, what's now standing on the Temple Mount is the Dome of the Rock Mosque, and has been since the 8th century. It's a very holy site for Islam. But Christian and Jewish fundamentalists are eager to get their hands on that, and that's part of what is so volatile about the whole situation in the Middle East. So I need to give over my time to my colleague now, but if we both abide by our covenant, we're going to have 20 minutes of discussion, and I'm happy to talk more about the Bible passages here, the whole script. Oh, I'll just say one more. Another text that they cite a lot is Matthew 24, the parable of the fig tree. Let's take a look at that one. They say, this is a favorite one, and Hal Lindsey got this as a revelation. You know, Hal Lindsey, late great Planet Earth in the 70s. This was his big text, where Jesus says, from the fig tree learn its lesson. As soon as its branches become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. All right, Hal Lindsey got the revelation that the fig tree parable is about the founding of the state of Israel, that these things referred to 1948. Okay, and that the fig tree is Israel. So that now Jesus is telling us, hey, be alert. Israel's been founded. That means that the end is near. It's the fig tree. But, you know, you can see how this is reading stuff into a text. Jesus is coming. I mean, I believe that. And it's part of our creeds. He will come again to judge the living and the dead. But the question is, whether Jesus ever decreed that the state of Israel had to be founded. And I'm a supporter of Israel. I believe in it. I think it's important. But I also believe in a Palestinian state, and I don't think that Bible texts should be thrown around like Bible bullets to support absolutist and extreme policies in either camp. I don't think the parable of the fig tree is about the state of Israel. I think other texts can be used. But even if you say God decrees the founding of the state of Israel, then you would use the biblical prophets who call for Israel to practice justice and not to be stealing land. Like a lot of Palestinian Christians will talk about the parable of, or the story of Ahab and the vineyard and the stealing of land that Israel has done. But I'll leave that to Lauren.
Okay, thank you. Well, we want to leave time for discussion, but
I think I did pretty well.
You could. I told you she could talk fast. I can't talk that fast. We'll leave time for discussion at the end, but if there's any burning questions of clarification that you would like to ask right now, how about if you direct those to Barb and then I'll start it.
Uh-huh. One thing I have wondered, Barb, about the Temple Mount, does the current structure there have to be destroyed for the temple to be built there?
All right, that's a good question. Now, that's debated. Gorenberg takes that one up. I highly recommend it. He has great chapters in here. He's got this really funny one called The Cattlemen of the Apocalypse.
It's
about this
book.
Whole red heifer idea. It's hilarious. But he talks about this one guy. Where is it? Oh, man, maybe I lost the place. Well, anyway, who got a revelation about where the, I mean, the archaeology that he does in here is so funny too, because he can find some archaeologists who can say that actually the Jewish temple was over here in the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, so that you conceivably could have both of them there together. But that's disputed by others. I mean, if you go to the Dome of the Rock, which sadly you can't right now, but it's definitely got the rock right there in the center. It's very moving to see that rock, and that's the rock where Abraham supposedly was told to sacrifice Isaac, and it's the rock then that was part of the temple and is part of the Dome of the Rock Mosque, because for Muslims, also the story of Abraham is very holy, and the tomb of Abraham and Sarah in Hebron is very holy. This also is a mosque. I mean, so these are holy places for everybody. So yeah, I mean, he talked about people who have supposedly figured out or gotten a revelation that it, the two could coexist side by side. And maybe that is the argument. On the other hand, he also cites many Jews who do not think the temple needs to be rebuilt. And what I would say here is that this this prophecy has already happened. I mean, it's not like God has to do it again in order to fulfill the Bible. The desolation that Daniel is talking about happened at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes in 163 BC. And the temple had to be re-sanctified. That's the story of Hanukkah. Yeah, with the lamps. Okay. I might have made a mistake there. No. So it's already happened in 163. And then it happened again in 70. The Romans desecrated the temple. So it's, hey, it's already been fulfilled twice. We don't need it to happen a third time. It's not like there's prophecy waiting to be fulfilled. But they have this rabid sense that prophecy hasn't been fulfilled. The one that's the most ridiculous is in the Pentecost story in Acts, you know, where Peter, we just had that read. Where people think, oh, they're drunk, you know, because people are speaking in different languages, we're all understanding. And then Peter says, no, this is the fulfillment of the prophet Joel. In those last days, I will pour out my spirit, your sons and daughters will prophesy, your old men will dream dreams, you know. LaHaye and Jenkins say that prophecy has not been completely fulfilled, even though the Bible says it was. They say, well, it wasn't completely fulfilled because Peter goes on to say the sun will be turned, will be darkened, the moon will turn to blood. It's just like Joel said. And LaHaye and Jenkins say, no, it wasn't, because the sun didn't darken and the moon didn't turn to blood. So even that prophecy is waiting to be fulfilled and has to happen in the end times. But that's where they twist scripture in ridiculous ways of saying things haven't been fulfilled that even the Bible says have been fulfilled. Sorry, I'm getting all worked up here. it just bugs me, because you think that must be what the Bible says, and even I was, you know, intimidated by it, because you hear it on TV all the time, and now I finally realize that is not what the Bible says. They're making it up.
Okay, there you are. What I would like to do is, we took a trip to into the Middle East this last December and lived in East Jerusalem for about 3 weeks, and then did some travel. We went as far north as you can go in Israel and as far south, and we spent some time in the West Bank areas, and even took a trip over into Jordan. We didn't let much time pass without doing something, and I want to kind of do a little bit of a kind of a mixture of a travelogue, storytelling, and maybe a little theology to hopefully to shed some light and to give us some more tools to picture this, because this is so confusing, so complicated, that often you get to the point where you think, I don't even want to hear about the Middle East ever again. It's just too painful. It's just too confusing. One day I'm rooting for one side. The next day I'm rooting for the other side. I'm just exhausted. And I think that's pretty typical of a lot of people. I would like to help you come to a sense that maybe that you can pay attention and not have that sense of exhaustion. The first thing, and this is to kind of build off of what Barb said, is that I'm assuming that most people in here are not premillennial dispensationalists. But most of you, if as people in the United States, you're probably a lot like me, that when you kind of boot up in the morning, to use a computer image, you boot up with as I'm an Israeli, in a sense. And it may not be in your head, but I think it's in our bones. When I was a kid, I heard the Bible stories. I heard about Israel. I heard about the Promised Land. I heard about God's promise. I heard the stories. And then there were the Philistines. Oh my gosh, the Philistines that needed to be, that surrounded Israel, that needed to be slaughtered. I heard about the Ammonites, the Edomites, all the ites surrounding Israel and God delivering his people over and over and over again. I remember reading, what was the movie? Exodus. Oh my gosh.
This land is mine, God gave this land.
Very powerful stuff. I saw the movie. There was no doubt in my mind who were the good guys, who were the bad guys. When I was a kid, I rooted for, I rooted for Fords over Chevys. I rooted for there were no major league teams in California, so I rooted for the Dodgers over the Yankees. I rooted for the Israelis over the Arabs. It was clear who were the good guys. So that's my argument for where we boot up. It's just in our bones. And as time passed, these senses started to fade. But at the same time, I began, and this is where I want to start a little bit of a story of a progression, because it paralleled an experience I had. I went to on a bus down to the, Barb was doing something else, and I went on a bus.
I was preaching at church.
Yes, you were preaching at church. Thank you, dear. I went on a bus down to the old city of Hebron, which is one of the most holy of holy place for Jews and Arabs.
That's Abraham's tomb.
Abraham's tomb. It is very, very moving to go there. And on the bus, I sat next to a young Israeli, interesting young woman, who only maybe 10 years ago had been a young woman who was a Christian from the Midwest. She had, as a young girl, started reading about the Holocaust and became so consumed with this vision. And as she read history, she realized that the Holocaust was the pinnacle of 2,000 years of persecution of the Jews. She became enraged with her own faith, and she lost it. She converted to Judaism, immigrated to Israel. She even became an Orthodox Jew, which allowed her to become an Israeli citizen. She's telling me this story. On this bus trip, which was a part of Peace Now, which is the main anti-occupation group in Israel, the peace group, and at some point she came to discover what was going on in the occupied territories. Her sense of justice was overwhelming. And now the struggle is within her, is just as she became incensed with what Christians had done to Jews, now she has become incensed with what Jews are doing to the Arabs in Palestine. And she's going down, I'm just wondering if I ever run into her again, where this is gonna play out, because I think she can hardly stand to live in Israel anymore. And probably that was certainly not as extreme, but that was some of the emotions I was going through, where I, as a young person, was reading stories of the Holocaust and living in this horror. How could this have happened? And then coming to the Middle East and seeing what I was seeing, I was thrown over to the other side emotionally, and it was just gut-wrenching. So I would like to talk a little bit about what I call a night in hell. And this was our first trip down to Hebron, where we took what we called a settler bus. This is an armored bus. It's armor-plated. It's just coated with this much armor, bulletproof or armor-proof glass all the way around. The thing is just a tank. And we had a military escort as we traveled on what's called a settler road. Can I erase?
some of this? Or
well, I don't know. Okay.
Maybe take a little place over
okay,
here.
Okay, okay.
Thank you.
All righty, raise it all. Sure.
I'll do it right here. What I was seeing was, let's just say these are Palestinian urban areas.
In the West Bank.
In the West Bank.
In what is Palestinian territory, but it has these settlements.
Over the years, what has happened is that they are just simply surrounded by settlements. And if these are the existing roads between the urban areas, all settlements are connected by roads that cut through these existing roads. This is no accident. It's very intentional, and it's a strategy. What they call it is facts on the ground. And in addition to that, all the water, all the power is all hooked up and controlled by Israelis, so that all travel and all life is controlled in every way and in every detail. This has been a conscious strategy. So as we were traveling along, you could look over and you could see the berms of earth that are piled up at every one of these junctions of the red and the green, so that wherever there's a green road here, which would be the Palestinian, you can't travel on it. There's big earth mounds where you cannot travel across. The only places you can get across are what are called checkpoints, in which if you want to take something in a car from one side to the other, you have to unload it, carry it across, and then load it up onto something else. There's simply no way to have normal travel. So we're driving through this, seeing the piles of dirt, seeing the lines, seeing people walking, and it's just incredible. You just can't believe what you see. I'm advocating that you think of it as another Holocaust. But when you use that term, you automatically be accused of being anti-Semitic and that you are against Israel. So when you start to go into those emotions, you're going into some hostile territory for a lot of people. And I've seen that played out in this room last year. So the night we spent in Hebron is that we went on the settler bus, drove through one of the major settlements, which was one of the big green, the red things up there called Kiryat Arba. We went through this area, which is a very, very nice place to be. It'll have the sprinkler systems, it'll have lots of water, and then we drove through it and we went on down the hill and we were dropped off in downtown in the Hebron. And I was terrified, and Barb, I know, was scared. You know, right over maybe as far as that post, there was a pile of sandbags where two Israeli soldiers were stationed. You could hear them conversing. We were just standing out there in the dark, and anybody could have done anything, whether the person was from Islamic Jihad or whether the person was a settler. We were absolutely naked in a very violent, violent area. Just before we had gotten there, there had been an attack on by the Islamic Jihad group on some Israeli soldiers, and it had been a pitched battle. And that was only maybe a quarter mile away or something on the other side of the mosque. So we spent the night, and I remember just the sounds of people under occupation, people in lockdown, people who weren't allowed to leave their homes 24/7.
Israelis could go out, the settlers could go out.
The settlers who had, and the reason they were there is they had simply taken over some buildings, and where an Israeli sleeps, an Israeli defends. So that means that the army must, by definition, defend where this settlement is. It's simply law. So there you have 450 settlers guarded by 5,000 soldiers. The Palestinians are simply locked into their homes, and we were listening to the sounds of these people. We went out the next morning, and I think this is the crux of the story, is that we were sort of grabbed. We were traveling with a Christian peacemaker representative. And she, this Palestinian father, came and just said, come and have tea, come and see my children. Well, I knew this was going to be a while. And so we came in, and of course we had Palestinian hospitality. The tea came out, and we were greeted formally in the living room. His two little girls were crawling all over him, these giggly little girls. And here I could see this man, the tension in his body. There was a noise outside, and he jumped like that. It could have been a settler with an AK-47 coming in. It could have been an IDF soldier to bash in the door and search the place. Think of yourself living in a tent, and you're surrounded by lions and tigers, pythons. That's what life would be like for these people. That was our night in hell, and it took me a couple of days to start to calm down again from the fear. I had a passport. I had a protector. I could walk everywhere. These people are simply, they are under occupation and have no rights.
And it's 100,000 people, Palestinians, who live in Hebron, and 400 some settlers. So the 100,000 have to be locked up so that the 450.
I'm not being a good little puppy here. I'm spending too much time.
Okay, you have 5 more minutes.
Okay. Another story was our trip into Jerusalem,
Bethlehem,
on Christmas Eve. Actually, it was our second trip. The first trip we went in when we heard the occupation, the curfew was lifted. We raced in with Michael Thomas, the pastor of Redeemer Lutheran in the Old City. We got out of this car, climbed up and over the berm, got into a taxi, raced downtown Bethlehem, and spent some time talking with Nitri Raheb, the pastor of Christian Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. We had only a quick amount of time, and we knew we better get ourselves out of there because the curfew would be closed at dark. We spent a little bit too much time, and we came out as darkness was falling, and I could tell Michael was really scared. As we raced along, and suddenly this place that had teeming cars and traffic, it was suddenly people in panic because they knew that they were also late. And I remember this almost nightmarish run down this street as we were looking for a cab. I remember seeing the posters of the martyrs going by me. I could see people racing across, knowing that if a tank comes down, that they can be snatched. And God knows what happens then, whether a bone is broken or they're beaten or just simply sent home. So we were in Bethlehem, and we were at another little demonstration against the occupation, and we were right next to us were two young men also with their signs. Well, we started talking, and pretty soon we had this wonderful conversation. They were Palestinian Christians. For those of you that want to, this is a wonderful book. I'm a Palestinian Christian. It's in the bookstore. This is the library copy. Please take a look at it. You hear another voice in there. And then we went to their home. And as you're walking down this narrow street, every door is a metal ring door. Everyone has had dents in it from being bashed in from the searches. We came to one of the metal doors that had been bashed in, and we went inside, and we were invited to this wonderful family who once again spread their table before us, and it was an extended family. The grandfather was sitting, staring out the window, smoking incessantly, and we heard their stories, not spoken in bitterness and anger, but simply said in stories, and we saw, once again, civility, love, and kindness. And so when I tell these stories, it sounds like, okay, I'm supposed to persuade you to pick the Palestinians as being the ones to root for. That I am not wanting to do. I am advocating you also not root for the Israelis. even though that's our boot up, I'm advocating that when we that we fight against this notion that God is empowering the Israelis because they're God's chosen people. I'm also advocating that we not favor the Palestinians. What I'm advocating is, and this is really a good book, if you want to dig into something and really read a good solid history, Benny Morris, Righteous Victims, A History of the Zionist Arab Conflict, 1881 to 2001. And I just want to read a short paragraph.
And he's an Israeli.
He's an Israeli. I think this is really the core of his thesis. And he's saying it for the years 1882 to 1914, but it's really describing now. But the major cause of tension and violence throughout the period of 1882 to 1914, okay, this has been going on a long time, was not accidents, misunderstandings, or the attitudes and behaviors of either side, but objective historical conditions and the conflicting interests and goals of the two populations. The Arabs sought instinctively to retain the Arab and Muslim character of the region and to maintain their position as rightful inhabitants. The Zionists sought radically to change the status quo, buy as much land as possible, and that's how they were doing it, they was buying land, settle on it, and eventually turn an Arab population country into a Jewish homeland, which meant excluding Arabs from the land. That's been a core Zionist goal. It is that paragraph summarizes today. Two peoples fighting over one land. When you think of it that way, you no longer are chained to start rooting for one side or the other. You think of it as two people fighting over the same land. I think I'll just stop there, and I have, of course, 20 more minutes to go.
Well, okay, can I just add one thing? One thing we heard from an Israeli guy named Jeff Halper, who grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but has now moved back for the last 30 years, lives in Israel, and he runs this organization called Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. I think that's their name,
yeah.
Is it?
Uh-huh, yeah.
ICAHT. He is wonderful. And his argument was, when you think of the sides, who to root for, it's the way we construct the sides. He says we need to be on the side of Israelis and Palestinians who are working for peace. So that group the sides as, on the one side are Israelis and Palestinians working for peace, who want the two-state solution, the roadmap, who want it to work. And the Palestinian homeland then has to be viable. It has to be a territory with
contiguity.
Contiguity, okay. So, but those people, he would say, are on one side. And then on the other side are Israelis and Palestinians who are opposed to peace, who are trying to create violence. And he says both sides include both Israelis and Palestinians. But that's how to construct the sides. And I think that was what was so helpful to us. And he was an Israeli. Who encourage us to see the sides that way, and that would be our thesis that we want to suggest here as well. Okay, questions, comments, responses? Uh-huh.
Why does it matter who we root for? Do we have to root for somebody?
Well, we're funding it. That, I guess, is the way the United States roots for people is by giving them billions of dollars.
Your tax dollars at work.
Yeah, and currently we do support the Palestinian Authority somewhat, but we support Israel to a much, much greater extent, especially military sales. I mean, that's what's troubling. We actually give in USAID every year $500 per Israeli citizen. So we are doing a lot of rooting. I mean, this is the largest foreign aid recipient in our entire budget, and it's huge, the support for Israel. In addition, then we just passed the loan guarantees of another $10 billion. And what this is funding is the settlements. I mean, Israel subsidizes these outposts and settlements hugely. People don't, actually, it's interesting, the surveys of Israelis who are living in the settlements, only 30% or less are there for ideological reasons, because they think Israel has to take over the land. The other 60% or so are just there because it's cheap, nice housing. I mean, Michael Thomas was telling us his dentist lives in a settlement called Ariel. It's a really ritzy, upscale, gated community, and you have more land, and it's cheaper. So that it's, and that's paid for by us, essentially. It's paid for by Israel, but they get their money from the United States. So that's the sense in which we root for somebody, I guess, is money. the simplistic.
Can you just give us a reminder that what is it that Sharon is giving in now? Is that something to do with removing some of the settlements from occupied land, right?
No, it's moving, the word is outposts. I saw in the paper where they were going to dismantle an outpost. Now, the outposts that they're talking about dismantling are nothing but abandoned trailers or with water tanks, which is according to, you know, which is still contested. You know, nobody wants, that's viewed by the most extreme as caving in and giving up land. And you don't want to give up one inch of land. So they, even taking back an empty trailer, the settlements, my gosh, you see a settlement and these things look like fortresses on hills. I wish we had a picture of this one settlement, Mali Adumim, in what's called the Israeli or the Jerusalem neighborhoods, when in fact it's, these settlements are being used as a strategy to just simply cut the West Bank into two, north and south. It's this massive structure that looked like it has towering walls. That's a settlement. Those aren't being abandoned. They have thousands of people in them.
But they, under the Oslo Accords, they should have been. I mean, that ultimately is the only way that peace can come, I believe, is that there are about 400,000 Israelis now living in the West Bank. 200,000 are in those settlements deep into the West Bank, like Lauren's talking about. Then another 200,000 are in areas around Jerusalem that have been taken, because Jerusalem is East Jerusalem that's Palestinian, West Jerusalem that's Israeli. It's all been taken since 67, and the problem is that's a lot of votes. But most, Jimmy Carter, most peace-loving people, even Bush, I believe, and certainly Bush's father.
No, the latest statement still, the formal position is the settlements are an obstacle to peace.
And so one of the ideas is the settlements could all be abandoned, and that could then be housing for the returning Palestinians. Because one of the key questions is what happens to all the Palestinian refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, and around the world who were driven out in 1948 or fled, depending on whose story you believe. They need somewhere to come back to. They have wanted to insist on the right of return to Israel, to their houses that they left in Israel. But one possible compromise would be that they would have the right of return to Palestine, that is to the West Bank and Gaza, and then that all the 400,000 apartments that are already there that have been housing settlers could in some way provide housing for the returning refugees. Uh-huh.
One of the things that I think is a big source of confusion for Americans is, I mean, obviously our media doesn't help, but the whole idea of the words that are used, you know, settlements, facts on the ground, outposts,
it's
not helpful, and that's designed to be not helpful, so that we are confused, so that we eventually throw up our hands and say, I don't care, or I can't stand it anymore. I mean, my mother listens to National Public Radio, she has for years. She doesn't get it, even though I think that they do, I don't think they do a great job, but they're probably about as good as anybody as far as trying to communicate what's happening. It is because, you know, we think about a settlement in America as, you know, we went out, we're homesteaders. You know, we have these good stories about being a settler. We're a colonist. It's not a settlement.
It's a colony.
It's robbery.
You know, from an international perspective, these are colonies. These are colonists. We shouldn't call them settlers.
Even that was a good word.
Yes, yeah, that's the problem. No, you're right. Even the terminology. Yes, and they're not buying land. I mean, the passage Lauren read was about before 48. I mean, now Israel just seizes West Bank land. And one of the stories that Mitri Rahav has in that book, I Am a Palestinian Christian, is about this family named the Daher family, Daher's Vineyard, which it's spooky how much that echoes the story of Ahab. Who stole the vineyard in the Old Testament? Yeah, Ahab. Of just taking somebody's vineyard. I mean, that is exactly what's happening with the Daher family, and that's happening over and over, is simply taking land. Now, with this fence idea, it's not a fence, it's a wall. It's 24 feet high. We saw it. It's much taller and thicker than the Berlin Wall or anything was. And that is not following the what is called the Green Line. It's not following what's the internationally recognized border between the West Bank and Israel. It's deep into the West Bank. So Israel is simply confiscating the land on the other side of that wall and doing it without compensation. So yeah, but yeah, if settlement is a good word, then I can see. Christine?
The other story or mythology besides the Old Testament that plays out very deeply for us as Americans is the whole settlement of the West.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for us, I think, to look honestly at what's happening in the Mideast, we need to take, it means facing things in our own American
uh-huh.
history that we don't want to face
mm-hmm.
and that are still, you know, I just moved from North Dakota 2 years ago, and reservations are occupied territory. And, the Palestinian camps,
right.
sort of. And our whole treatment, the Little House on the Prairie mythology, it does not do anything to talk about how we treated the people who were here when we came. And I think that's another complicating mythology for us as Americans as we try to enter into the Mideast story, because we have done our own occupying.
Demythologizing
yeah,
is a very important task for us.
That's hard for us to look at ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Lauren and I were talking earlier, the title of that book, Righteous Victims, is fascinating to me. I haven't read the book yet, but we also now, since 9/11, are righteous victims.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, this story is becoming more and more our own story, too. And how my concern, I just traveled here by plane, and checkpoints have been searched. What's happened to our country in the last couple of years? We are looking more and more like the situation that we are struggling. We're talking here about struggling against.
Yeah, I'd like to.
And I don't know. It's just it's not only over there. There's stuff here
yeah.
in our
to build on that. There's an Israeli journalist. Her name is Amira Haas, who has the phrase "the Israelization of America." And I've heard that phrase, and it's been working away in my mind. And I just, there's a picture that I saw, I'm going through the magazines, and yes, I confess, I swiped a couple of magazines. I'm going to put them back. There's a picture of an American soldier bending over. There's an Iraqi, looks like a teenager, bound and on his knees like this. And the picture is him doing this. This is what our soldiers are doing. We're out there scolding Iraqis. And where are we headed? And here is an article.
Okay, well now this is your radical side.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're starting to buy into it too.
No, I can't.
Okay, Robert D. Kaplan has written a lot of books. I read one of them a long time ago. Balkan Ghosts. He's really good. But I really disagree with this guy. Atlantic Monthly, he's very bright. His article is 10 Rules for Managing the World. His statement is, let's quit arguing whether or not we're an empire. We are an empire. The only issue is that we firm it up and we expand it. And so he goes through the different rules. I really recommend sitting down with this and thinking, what does it mean? Frankly, I find him persuasive. And I'm terrified by the fact that I find him persuasive, because you start to think, my gosh, you know, this could really work. We can really use the military means to democratize the whole world, because that is the dream. So he goes, I just want to read one thing at the very end. Okay, please. His last thing is, his rule number 10 is speak Victorian, think pagan. And this is the sentence. Winston Churchill saw the United States as a worthy successor to the British Empire, one that would carry on Britain's liberalizing mission. We cannot rest until something emerges that is just as estimable and concrete as what Churchill saw when he gazed across the Atlantic. So we're really in our sense heading towards this righteous victim, because now once we have that frame of mind, anything's thinkable. Another one is a good article to read and a good magazine. This is wonderful. Tikkun, the mean is to mend and repair and transform, to mend, repair, and transform the world. The article in here, and this is also published by an Israeli rabbi, Rabbi Michael Lerner, I think. The title is "The Civil Liberties Crisis and the Threat of, quote, Too Much Democracy." This is really something, because he's talking about some young Jewish young men who were hired by Scoop Jackson, who was the senator from the state of Washington back in the 70s. Scoop was famous for being opposing detente with the Russians and to fighting them militarily. These two men were Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle. They're forming a larger group that they consciously think of themselves as a cabal, and their view is spreading democracy, that you can have too much democracy, and that it takes an elite group to kind of moderate it. And we're living these things out now, and that you can spread democracy by military means.
What I'll just say, what's really great about Tikkun, from my perspective, is it's edited by a Jewish rabbi, Michael Lerner, and it's really an important thing to lift up, that there are American Jews who oppose the unquestioned military support for Israel just as much as Gentiles do. So that we can't let it become a sort of, and criticism of Israel's military occupation can't be cast as anti-Semitism, which we as Lutherans really do have to worry about. We have that in our history very much. But so that's why it's really important to find the American Jewish community voices, and which are diverse. I mean, the American Jewish community supports this largest lobby group called AIPAC that is very powerful, that will target senators or representatives or anybody who tries to do anything moderate in the Middle East. But there are American Jews who oppose AIPAC and who have a different voice. And they also, I think they've got a really good website. The ELCA, I'll just say, our church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, has a website. If you go to elca.org, there's a good section on the Middle East that is tended by Anne Hafton, who's going to be, she was up here last summer on teaching staff. She comes to Holden often. She has a book coming out, I can put that up, called Water from the Rock, that is Palestinian Lutheran Voices on the Middle East. So it would have chapters by Mitri Raheb, by Bishop Munib Yunan, the Lutheran bishop in Jerusalem, Pastors Michael and Susan Thomas, who are the missionaries or the ELCA pastors there. They're going to be on teaching staff here in July for 2 weeks. They'll have articles in there and others. So you can find that stuff on the ELCA webpage, and you can also find the Lutheran Jewish dialogue stuff. And I think both pieces are really important. So in no way does support for Palestinian Christians and an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank mean anti-Judaism. We must really be careful about that, but it's simply calling for an end to a military occupation. So that book coming out, it's going to be available in July. It's not out yet. It's Augsburg Fortress, Water from the Rock, Palestinian Lutheran Voices, edited by Anne Hafton, who is the ELCA Middle East liaison with congregations. And I think we really do need to be seeking ways for partnership with our congregations with Palestinian Christians, because the Christian Zionists are doing it so vociferously with settlements. I mean, that we went to Hebron just 2 weeks earlier. Roberta Combs, the head of the Christian Coalition of America, had been there embracing the Israeli settlers. I mean, there are close ties between Christian Zionists and Israeli settlers in these really militant communities.
Physically embracing.
Oh, yeah, a big hug. I mean, the Christian Zionists are organized and well-funded in their support for Israel's expansionism. And that's what Bush is now encountering, is this amazing kind of Christian opposition that his father didn't have 10 years earlier in the same way, because the Christian coalition was not so organized. All right, we've talked a lot. Comments, questions, responses?
It is frustrating when you think about what I think of the Christian message is, to love your neighbor and to take care of the poor and the less fortunate, and it just seems that the whole part of Christian fundamentalism embraced an entirely different message. Just
there are many areas of disagreements between the Palestinians and the Israelis in terms of settlements, the peace, one of which, of course, is Jerusalem. And I've been wondering, in your travels there, did you hear any discussion of the possibility of Jerusalem becoming an open city, one in which you belong to the world rather than to Palestinians or the Jews?
Yeah, we heard that from Jeff Halper. He gave a lecture in the Old City. He's actually talking about his vision is much greater as far as sharing. I think he was talking, he was even against a two-state solution. He thinks that Jews and Arabs need to share. But he's coming from the left. Ultimately, Jerusalem does need to be a shared capital. And probably the voices of those that want peace know it. The voices who believe they can defeat the other militarily don't want to hear it. And those are the ones who are really making a racket now. I've heard from those who have come in, who brought news in, just saying, my gosh, it's really coming down. And you can absolutely, you know, when you hear about the roadmap, you can predict it. The roadmap would come out, and then the terrorists on both sides would be active.
But there could, it's becoming harder and harder because Israel is definitely trying to bring all of Jerusalem with these settlements. There's one now right between Jerusalem and Bethlehem called Har Homa. But there would have to be some dismantling of that. I mean, some of the new settlements around Jerusalem would have to go. But you could envision a way that it could be jointly administered, but still two communities. I mean, there are ways that it's being proposed. And we had posters up here a few years ago, Committee for a Shared Jerusalem. That was what we were really advocating for, and hopefully it's still the vision. Although things become tougher and tougher as facts on the ground make it more and more difficult to have two viable communities.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think you're right about facts on the ground and all this stuff, but there are people who think it's the habits of the mind and its facts and our thoughts that are things that fundamentally have to change. And it's a theological project. And what would be interesting, since you're a New Testament scholar who can read the Revelation texts that are the inspiration for the Christian Zionists, would be to pair up with, there's actually some Orthodox Jewish scholars who go back to say the problem goes back to those first brothers and the sharing that has to occur. And that criticism of the interpretation, which has another manifestation in the need for a post-Holocaust theology on the Jewish side. And there's a fellow whose name I can't remember right now, Mark Ellis, right. And on the Palestinian side, the Christian inspiration, Naeem Atif?
Yeah, this organization called Sabil. Yeah,
that's another good one.
Right.
We visited with him too.
Yeah. But I would think if you could get those four theological perspectives together, and recognize that, people act out of how they think. If you can't inform a change of how they think, then the righteous victims will act just like we can see ourselves beginning to act as righteous victims who now think empire is justified.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, and Revelation has the resources of that. I mean, if you go to the New Jerusalem vision of Revelation, and granted that the Jews won't accept that because it's a Christian text, but Christians should, and I don't know how the Christian Zionists get away from it. I mean, or how they get away from where Jesus says in John chapter 2, destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days. And then John says he meant the temple of his body, not the physical temple. The physical temple does not need to be rebuilt. I mean, they ignore whole scale these passages. And in Revelation 21 and 22, the vision of God's new Jerusalem welcomes all nations. Over and over, the word nations is in it. It's not a Jewish vision. It's not a Gentile vision. It's all nations together sharing the holy city of Jerusalem. And we have that vision, and that is completely ignored in this Christian Zionist script. So yeah, we have it, the resources for a different kind of imagining of God's future that is sharing and peaceful. I mean, that I guess I think, though, I just want to leave you with that if it's not just facts on the ground, but facts in our head, try to stop thinking of the two sides as Israelis and Palestinians and start thinking of the two sides as Israelis and Palestinians who want peace. and Israelis and Palestinians who commit violence. Because Mitri Rahab, these Palestinian Lutheran pastors are every bit on the side of Israel and its right to exist, as well as Palestine and its right to exist. And there are many Israelis, like the ones Lauren rode on the bus with, who want Palestine to be able to exist as a viable state.
And the
they
Israelis
are on the same side together, and that's the side we need to be on. And don't let somebody construct a side so that when you hear of bombings and stuff, and Israeli military, you know, tit for tat, those are the side of violence. And of course, in both communities, there are violent voices. But we need to support a side that works for peace. And there are people in both communities who want that.
Well, I'd like to just close with a Bible verse that I suggest is, rather than all the text, there's talk about all the things that those advocate. I think this is a much better text to close with. From Amos chapter 5, verse 21, I hate, I despise your religious feasts. I cannot stand your assemblies. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I will have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like an everlasting stream, never failing stream. Thank you.
Thank you.
This one I really like, For the Healing of the Nations, The Book of Revelation in the Age of Cultural Conflict by Justo Gonzalez is in there, as is this one, The End of Days, and I Am a Palestinian Christian is there. And then if you want to read some of my Bible studies on Revelation before the book comes out, then in the study book for the Lutheran World Federation Assembly for the Healing of the World, I wrote the Revelation text. But my new book will be out in about a year, so. This is in the bookstore, on the teaching staff shelf. All of these are. So I need to, and then one that I've been reading, but I didn't order it because it's too hardback, and we don't order hardbacks, is a brand new one by an evangelical named Gary Burge, evangelical New Testament scholar, Whose Land, Whose Promise, and he directly addresses Christian Zionists and the people in the evangelical community with Bible verses and stuff that's interesting. What Christians are not being told about Israel and the Palestinians, but it's only hardback reading.